Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cap from Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to our radio show on restaurantguysradio.com or download those podcasts on iTunes.
And you can also follow us on Twitter, at Restaurant Guys. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
You know, Mark, today we don't really have a lot of work in front of us.
Well, we've done most of the work, Francis.
We have. This is a show that we've recorded. We're going to take you down to Tales of the Cocktail, and today we're just going to narrate for you or introduce to you some interviews we did down at Old New Orleans Rum.
Yeah, we spent a very interesting place. We spent a good deal of time down there.
One of the reasons we decided to stop is we love these rums, and the distillery is in New Orleans itself. Eric Luco, who works there, came and picked us up and drove us over, and we talked a little bit about New Orleans and the history of New Orleans and spirits on the way there. Why don't we have a listen? All right, now we're in the car with Eric Luco. Eric Luco is with Old New Orleans Rum, and we've just left the Hotel Monteleone at Tales of the Cocktail, and we're venturing off in an automobile driven by someone else, rather wisely, Eric. And as we drive through the streets of New Orleans, we decided to visit your rum distillery, number one, because we love your rum, and you invited us, and your distillery right in the city, right? Where are we? Can you describe for our listeners where we're headed?
Well, we're passing the back of the French Quarter and heading to an area called Gentilly, which is kind of one of the first suburbs of New Orleans. And right before you get to that is an industrial area where our distillery is located. Coincidentally, when good old Hurricane Katrina decided to visit us, we had a waterfront property. Now, unlike most waterfront property, it didn't increase our property values much. But that's where we're heading. So where you're going is where actually, all joking aside, was where brunt of the devastation was. We took about 9 feet of water inside of the distillery, and you'll actually see the water line when you get there, as well as the racks where the barrels were stored. And there was, thankfully, a reasonable amount of product up high enough in the racks that survived, and we'll be tasting some of that rum today as well.
How old are the stocks of the rum that you have in the distillery?
Dating back to 1997 was when we first started working on this particular aged product. The product they pulled for the batch we have now was barreled in February of 2002. And that's what's actually on the bar at the distillery right now is 2002 product.
So what did you lose? I mean, how much product did you lose in Hurricane Katrina? And how do you recover an operation like a distillery? And how long did it take?
Well, the distillery, you know, the building itself was okay. It was a lot of cleanup. And thankfully, our equipment, a lot of it is recycled from the dairy industry. So it's big stainless steel sealed tanks. So internally, everything was fine. Externally, there was a lot of muck and mud that just needed to be rinsed off. So nothing was tainted as far as the equipment went, just a lot of cleanup. With regards to the rum, we probably lost about 60% of the barreled inventory, but then we were able to restart production. So aged rum, we did have enough to restart the brand again in 2006, and clear rum production is, you know, and I almost want to say instantaneous, let's say a couple of weeks, but once the stills were back up and running, we were able to get back in business about a year and a half after the storm, once the building was ready, everything had been inspected, and we got all our licensing back online to crank back up after all the inspections were done.
How did Katrina affect you guys in the long run?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the biggest things, the company's name change. We used to be called New Orleans Rum prior to the storm. After the storm, when people were coming back, and there was a lot of talk, especially in the media, about, oh, the city of New Orleans is different. It's been wiped clean, and it's, you know, washed away, and everything's good and new again. And I looked at the French Quarter and go, guys, these are the same buildings that were here before. Still smells the same. Still a bunch of drunks running up and down the street having a good time drinking crazy drinks. That hasn't changed, and you can't deny the history of the city, which was built on the foundation of the port of New Orleans and the sugarcane and cotton trade, and sugarcane being the main ingredient in what goes into rum. So we actually changed the name to Old New Orleans Rum as a way of paying homage to the city that we love and the hundreds of years of its history. But if you see some buildings with a circle spray painted with an X through it, the X, each quadrant of the X gave a code for whether or not they found people, the number of people they found, survivors, you know, people didn't survive, and so on. And that's how they went through the city after the storm. Literally cans of spray paint and the workers from the police and fire departments going and checking the buildings, making sure that anybody that was a survivor got out, and anybody that didn't make it, they made sure they were handled properly.
That was a pretty intense conversation. It's really wild still to walk around down there, especially when you get out of the Garden District in the French Quarter, which have been so well rebuilt, and you're out there, And, you know, there was a hurricane there 6 years
ago. And just seeing that how many of the buildings still have the watermarks from where the hurricane came up, it was just, it's just amazing and intense.
But, okay, so we drove there, right? Let's go talk about, we've talked about New Orleans now, but let's talk about rum. And what's amazing is you pull up to this distillery, it's a garage, right? It looked like a garage.
It was. You would never know except for the old New Orleans rum sign out front what was going on inside.
Which was the nicest thing in there, but it was pretty interesting what we found. Let's go talk some more with Eric Luco.
Okay, so we've just walked into the distillery here. It's an industrial building. I'm looking at cement mixers across the street. But, Mark, what do you think of the smell?
It smells like delicious butter rum candy. I want to make myself some bananas Foster.
It's very good. It's very good. Well, this is all cooking sugar and molasses. Is that where it's smelling?
Yeah, we are a true craft distillery. We start with raw materials. What you see here is two molasses tanks. There's probably about 1,000 gallons in this tank right in front of us. And it's Louisiana Blackstrap molasses. It comes from about 90 miles up the road. And that's what we start with. We're not a company that contracts out and has somebody else make it for us. We start from scratch and we ferment and distill here in the facility. The building that we're in, long, long time ago, in fact, the building's about 100 years old, was an old cotton warehouse. So, again, another one of the big trades, agriculture crops of New Orleans is cotton, along with sugar cane. So now it's just been converted, and we're dealing with a lot of the sugar cane. The racks you see are some of our staged barrels. Most of our barrel storage is actually upstairs in our mezzanine. We learned a little bit of a lesson with Hurricane Katrina that we might want to put the stuff on the second floor in case we get a little water in the building like we did during that storm.
You know, you're a craft distillery and you start with molasses from up the road. What do other distilleries do? They purchase molasses on the market?
With rum production, a lot of it's done in the Caribbean. So it's done where you'll contract through a distiller that makes product from multiple companies, and you go, hey, I have an idea and a cool design for a label. Let me start a quote-unquote distillery, and they contract out, and a tanker truck shows up with a distillate, and you blend it and create a rum after the fact, whereas we're starting with an old-school production facility in the way it was done hundreds of years ago.
That's pretty interesting. Well, why don't we walk on and you can show us the rest of your wonderful distillery. What are these? What do we have here? We're looking at three big glass jars. What are they, like 5 gallons?
These are 5 gallon actual water jugs that we'd use as water dispensing, like in offices. And what we did, we put them for display. So when we start our tour, so people understand where the product comes from and where it goes, we showcase the molasses. You can smell the molasses and check it out. And the next step is the polished distillate, which is, after the molasses is fermented and distilled, it actually goes from being a dark, thick, black syrup to the alcohol that's pulled from it via distillation, which is actually clear. Then the last jug you'll see is what the product looks like after it goes from just distillate stage to barrel aging, in which it spends years in an oak barrel that's retired from the bourbon industry. And the charring of the oak imparts a flavor and a profile not far from, say, a whiskey or a bourbon, with a little bit more of a sweeter note.
Cool. And so we go from black to clear to brown again.
Mm-hmm. We're in, what room are we in now?
This is one of the rooms where our washes are done, also our infusions for our spiced rum are done. This one is an exposed open wash tank. So when we do tours, people can see the process of what goes on in here. You hear this nice echo. It's just a room with a 900-gallon tank that's filled with a blend of the molasses and literally just good old-fashioned New Orleans tap water. The tap water thins the molasses, so when we add the yeast to create the fermentation process or start that process, the yeast can move around. The yeast, for lack of a better term, devours the sugar. The byproduct is alcohol. Distillation is what pulls the alcohol out of that wash.
So just to be clear, what we're doing here is we're taking molasses, which of course has a lot of sugar but no alcohol, and we're looking at how many gallons here?
This is 900 gallons in this tank.
So Mark and I are now looking at a 900-gallon tank of fermenting molasses, and you can see it bubbling like soda, and it smells awesome in here.
Yeah, this is a neat thing. It's, you know, funny how many people ask, well, what do we do to make the bubbles? And there's nothing except putting the yeast. The yeast is an enzyme that actually gets all the work done for us. This one's on the tail end. This one's probably on the last day or so. But when we first put the yeast in and it starts bubbling over, we have to have the doors open. The carbon dioxide release is so dramatic that it takes your breath away when you walk in the room. And at this point, it's about ready to go into our first still, which is our pot still.
So what we do is we take the molasses and you ferment it. And then by fermenting it, you get a certain low level of alcohol, and then you distill
the alcohol out of that to concentrate it, and that's what you get rum.
Exactly. This is almost a wine at this point. You know, it's not too far from wine or beer or the way that's done. Taking it to the high proof is where distillation comes in.
Is there a name for fermented molasses? Like the it's some distilling processes call it a wort. Some people, is there a name for rum?
You know, I'm not on the technical side, but, you know, it's called a wash here. Now, the byproduct, this is a neat story. When we, after we run our pot still, the leftover part of the wash that doesn't have the alcohol, it's already been extracted, is called the dunder, and it's very nitrogen rich. We barrel that, and that's actually sent off to a local plant nursery for composting.
Is this something we could taste?
You could, but it doesn't taste real good.
We've tasted other things that don't taste real good. It's all in the spirit of education. Can we try it?
Sure, absolutely.
Great. Tastes like a little molasses wine. It's you know, you can tell the sugar's mostly gone because it's not sweet anymore.
You see these tanks. These are, a lot of the tanks you see look like they came from the dairy industry, and that's because we did. We found a local dairy producer that was going under, and we bought all their equipment, mainly for storage. These three tanks are used for various things. The first tank is for blending our polished distillate to make our clear rum. The second tank is where we do a blend for our 10-year stocks. When we pull one or two barrels to do a blend of our 10-year products, we'll blend it in this tank. The third tank is for an infusion. And if you turn around, you'll see these spices on the shelf. There's cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, cayenne, Jamaican allspice, various spices that are used in the production of our Cajun spice rum. And those spices are naturally introduced over the course of about a month of an infusion. We do it in 300-gallon batches of distillate, so 300 gallons, but at a very high proof. To do an infusion right, you really need the higher proof of the alcohol. That's what strips the flavor from that particular spice or flavoring item into the spirit. And by using natural spices, the flavor is a little more robust, a little more intense, and a little more legitimate. You can't fool people from New Orleans when it comes to spices and flavors. That's what we're known for here as far as our cooking goes. And we take that same approach in liquor production, the same way chefs approach cooking in this city.
How long has it been since a rum was distilled in New Orleans? Is it a traditional thing for New Orleans?
There's been a bunch of moonshiners running around. But as far as running a rum still, it hasn't been one in probably since before Prohibition that I know of.
Oh, so we're looking at the pot still. This just looks like another wash tank, but it says pot still on it, so I trust you. And pot distillation. This is an expensive way to make any spirit, is pot distillation, as opposed to the more industrial ways of making rum. You guys do things kind of down and dirty here, you know, with what's at hand. How does this pot still work, and how did you, is this a repurposed something else that you made into a pot still?
Yes, this actually was built by our distillers. It was a dairy tank that's been retrofitted with steam channels that heat the wash, and then it's run up into the pot through a condenser and into another tank that collects the low wines. This particular still is not for final production. This is what you would call a stripping still, in that it takes the bulk of the alcohol out of the wash so that we have something cleaner to work with when we start to run our column still, which is where our final production is done. So this helps the process along and gives us a little bit better basis to run the column still off of.
So this is a combination of pot still and also column still?
Yes, we run two separate distillations in the production of our product. There's different companies, especially in the vodka world, you hear about 8, 9, and 10 times distilled, which really has to do with how the collectors are done in the column and whatnot. We actually run two separate distillation methods, and, you know, I'm not sure who else does it like this, but I've seen and tasted pot distilled rums and column distilled rums, and each have their own unique personalities.
So I have to tell you, it was the most jury-rigged thing I've ever seen in my life. It really was.
I have to admit that I am shocked at how good fermenting molasses smells.
Oh, and tastes.
And how bad fermenting molasses tastes.
See, that's the difference between you and me, because all the sweetness is gone and the bitterness is left. And as everyone knows, I'm more of a bitter fellow than you. But I could have done like a dry molasses wine. I think that's what's coming. I think that's the next thing.
Oh, no, it's wine. Not. No,
stop cookies.
It.
Dry molasses cookies.
Dry molasses cookies, maybe. Well, but we're going to add sugar.
You know, the thing about it, it's a very delicious product, and what they're talking about is it being partially pot-stilled and partially column-stilled. It's a pretty complex thing going on, but it does look like, he said it was repurposed dairy equipment. It looks like a repurposed 57 Chevy.
So it looks like there should be one coming out of the wall, that's for sure.
We're going to take you now to the column-still, and then we're going to talk about barrel aging. Really cool. So let's go and have a listen.
Okay, now right now we are standing next to what really looks like a tremendous, tremendously interesting science project. And this is like humming and whistling and making all sorts of noises. What's going on here?
This is actually a very old column still. Still is about 80 years old. It was used in perfume production years ago. It's actually been brought over from France. The buzzing that you may or may not pick that up, but the buzzing you're hearing is the column dumping into the holding tanks right behind us. They just pulled off, looking at the color and condition. This is the heads, which is all of your impurities. You know, the goal of the proper distillation is to engineer out all the bad stuff, effectively get out all the stuff that's not good for you and try and get as much of the hangover out of the bottle as possible. The heads are what do that. That's your ethanol, your acetone, stuff that you would do great running it through your engine in your car, but you don't want it through your body.
This is the most jerry-rigged thing I've ever seen, and I absolutely love it.
Obviously, the more heads and tails you take off, the less rum you have. So, I mean, that's a real decision that you need to make. You know, what's a head, what's a tail, and what's the middle?
Yeah, it is. It makes a big difference in the quality product. The deeper you take the cut, the better the product is, but also the more expensive it is to produce, and you got to find that balance. But we don't want to cheat the system. We want to do it right. And the heads are used mainly. We use them right here for cleaning tools. We've had a couple of paint companies that have bought it from us just to do some fun stuff with paint thinners. The tails are always run back through because that's where a lot of your essential oils and your heavier molecules that are flavor profiles that are pulled back in through the product.
That's White Dog. That's Moonshine.
So what I've just been handed right now is literally an actual mason jar with the White Dog that just came right out of the no aging, just came right out of the still.
Yeah. Making my own shine.
That's a little hot.
Yeah, it's about 160-170 proof.
Wow, it has filled my mouth with vapor.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. I mean, it's hot, but it's still you get the sense of it. Just it's a nice round, rich spirit. It's nice.
For as hot as the proof is, you can make one heck of a pina colada with that if you wanted to. But it is it's not a unpleasant taste for as high of a proof spirit. A lot of people think of the higher proof stuff and they think of brands like Everclear and, you know, some of the more harsh things out there that would do better running your lawnmower than in your stomach. This stuff actually tastes good.
You know, it's funny because we're standing here next to the heads, and the aroma of the heads made the tasting of the rum that I just tasted a little bit more disconcerting. Mm-hmm. You know, I can smell it because you took the moonshine away from me, and I'm still smelling the heads here, and it definitely adversely affected the way the flavor of the moonshine tasted.
And now, so you take this high spirit and then you rectify it down with water?
It's cut down a little bit to run through a filter, which we'll walk over to next. So we have a charcoal filtration system. We have our own homemade 6-foot-tall Brita water filter that we use.
Groovy.
I don't drink this, but you'll see what I mean, all the crazy flavors that are off that.
Okay, so these are the tails, different from the head, very different from the heads. I put my nose in just now, and it's still awful, but radically different. You know, a lot heavier, weightier, bassier.
Yeah, chemically and bad would be exactly right, but completely different than the heads that we smelled earlier. They're two completely different smells, but equally bad.
Yeah, excellent, perfect. They're tied. So how is New Orleans perceiving your rum? I mean, how's that going over here in town?
We do really well here, but where we found our forte to be in the mid to higher end restaurants that do unique cocktails. They also use a lot on the cooking side. Some of the better restaurants in town use this in a lot of their desserts. And then your mixology type venues where they're doing cocktails that really need a good basis of the spirit, we do well with.
You had mentioned to us before we came down here that you have a program going where you will send a barrel out to a bar or a venue, a small liquor barrel?
We have we did a bar here in town called Bat, and what is a small barrel, a 20-liter charred barrel, and what they do is they reintroduce the aged product to additional aging through a barrel program. The barrels are smaller barrels, but because the barrels are smaller, more of the surface area of the barrel touches the spirit, so the aging actually it works a little faster, but also because you're pulling the product directly from the barrels via a tap on the barrel, you're flowing product through. So there's some minor variances in the flavor, but you will pick up a little bit more unique flavor that is unique to that one venue with that one barrel. They're also doing some programs with a barrel-aged cocktails, where they use smaller 2-liter size barrels that are tabletop size, and you can order a cocktail for your group that was prepped possibly 3 to 4 weeks ago, stored, and if you want a rum Manhattan with Old New Orleans rum, it's been on the shelf aging for a couple of weeks. When it comes out to your table, I think it's 80 or 90 bucks, and it's enough to feed, you know, 4 or 6 people worth of cocktails that have been aging uniquely in their own little barrel.
So the guest can actually buy a barrel of aged cocktail.
Yes, yes. Now, you don't get to keep the barrel. They may have a souvenir T-shirt or something, but you don't get to keep the barrel. The barrel gets rerun again. The price you set on those barrels really is a unique and justifiable price for that type of cocktail that can't really be duplicated.
And speaking of stuff that can't be duplicated, one of the things that I find really interesting about this program is where you age something. It has a lot of effect, often more effect in distilled spirits than wine than the initial product, or at least as much. And so when you age something in cold and damp Scotland, you know, you get a very different kind of effect to the process than when you do in warm, dry Martinique. And here you have your old New Orleans rum that is all aged on site in humid, warm New Orleans. If you have a bar in Alberta, Canada, and you have a barrel behind your bar, you're going to have really a rum that is it's old New Orleans rum, but it's its own unique product.
Exactly, and that rum will be very specific to that one destination.
Well, one thing, if anybody knows Francis, you can rest assured that you're going to see an aged barrel of New Orleans rum on our bar in the near future.
And while Mark is going to really be in favor of that one aged barrel, the reason we're not going to have four of them is because Mark's going to restrain me because he's a financial partner in the business. But maybe we'll have two. We'll see how that'll work out. That's an argument yet to be had, but we have to turn off the recorder for that one, don't we?
Yes, indeed.
And this is the perfect spot, while those guys argue, for me to jump in with today's culinary public service announcement. The 7th Annual Chefs Congress is going to be held in New York City from September 30th through October 2nd, and that's just a few weeks away. Now, the Chefs Congress is a really cool event. It's a 3-day symposium put on every year by StarChefs.com. It's a huge learning experience and a networking opportunity. Some of the best and the brightest luminaries in the food, wine, and cocktail world are going to be there. Mario Batali, John Besh, Masaharu Morimoto, Marcus Samuelson, Johnny Uzzini, Jim Meehan, Audrey Saunders, you know, the people who've been on our show, all in one place, a culinary gathering of epic proportions. Seminars and classes and opportunity to meet all these folks, you got to check it out. Go to starchefs.com/ICC to learn more about it. If you want to buy tickets, use the code ICC199. That's for Restaurant Guys listeners to get a special price of $199 for the 3-day symposium. More than you think you could ever learn in 3 days. We'll be there. We hope to see you. Starchefs.com/ICC and use the discount code ICC199. We'll see you there.
Okay, so we're now in the little tasting room in the front of the garage that is this distillery, and we have the rums in front of us. Now we've tasted these rums before, but I think as long as we're here, we may as well go through a little tasting.
This looks like my favorite part of the tour.
Yeah,
so far.
It always is, right?
The 10-year and the Cajun spice are actually lighter than the 3-year, and there's a reason for that. You know, in New Orleans, you know, we're known for the sugar production. And what we do is we actually take cane sugar and cook it once a month. In a case of about a 50 to 60 pound sack of sugar down to a molten caramel. Most companies that do a dark rum that add a color additive, you know, call some type of company that makes coloring agents and says, I need a gallon of this to dump it into my rum to make it look nice. We don't do things that way. We use caramel that we cook naturally, blend it into a barrel to take the barrel a few shades darker so that when we cut it down to the bottling proof, it still has a nice amber finish to it.
Well, you know, when I was talking earlier about Bananas Foster, that's exactly the component that I was talking about. I was talking about that caramelized butter kind of note that's in Bananas Foster, and I get it in every one of your rums, more and more as we go older and richer.
Now we're on to the 10-year. Mark, what do you see?
Well, it's actually gotten paler in color again, because I'm sure that's based on the fact that you're no longer adding that caramel back into the rum. And, you know, it's interesting where you see that loss of color. I think for most places, they'd be disconcerted by the loss of color, so they would compensate some way unnaturally.
But the nose on this is really floral and, like, really punched up. You know, you can really, it's got a greater deal of complexity, more floral notes to it. And it's a lot more angular.
Yeah, we have a more serious rum here. There's no question about it.
I would say this is a rum for whiskey lovers. It has less of the lush feel that a lot of, if you're looking for a rum drink. And let's remember, you know, there are rums made all over the world. There are mainland rums made in Venezuela. There are island rums made in various islands of different nationalities, some from sugar, some from molasses. So we're talking about a mainland rum here to begin with. And with 10 years of age, you're going to get a certain sort of a whiskey feel to the whole shebang.
Real great addition to New Orleans culture. You're part of its old culture and new culture all at the same time.
Eric Luco, thanks for showing us around your distillery.
Anytime. Thank you for coming.
You can find out more about Old New Orleans rum and some cocktail recipes to use it in at restaurantguysradio.com. Look under this show, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Well, that was quite a little journey down to New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail.
It was a great trip. The whole trip was great, and I was really glad we took the time to go and visit there because it's always a different perspective. You always get a different perspective. And so as professionals, I think it's really important for us to go out to these types of places.
And, you know, Tales of Cocktails are really multifaceted five-day event of cocktaildom where, you know, the thing about cocktails and most liquor, honestly, is that cocktails are portable. But down in New Orleans, it's nice to go down and try the thing that they make down there. They should
Absolutely.
Be pretty proud of themselves.
Speaking of tiki, should we tell everybody about the Hawaiian tiki party we're going to be having here on September 30th?
Yeah, on September 30th in Stage Left, we're going to have Brian Miller and Julie Reiner going to come down to the bar on Sunday, September 30th.
We're going to roast a Hawaiian pig.
And they're going to actually get behind the bar and make some tiki drinks.
Yeah,
with,
it should be a lot of fun.
With us. We'll be together mixing drinks with the restaurant guys. So if you can come down on Sunday the 30th, come down to stay to Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. You give us a call at 732-296-9463 and make a reservation, or drop us an email at francis@restaurantguysradio.com. We hope to see you. Hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call